Hi everyone, it's Samila from Menswear by a Woman podcast. Welcome to another episode. Right, today's episode, I must say, I am so excited. As you all know, I always get excited by my guests. But this particular guest, right, the excitement about him is that he has the same drive and passion that I have for menswear. Now, he has the drive and passion for watches, but the way he goes about it, the way he probably wakes up, he thinks about watches, and I do the same about clothes, men's clothing. His name is Justin Hast, and I'm going to get him on board and talk about watches and menswear. Justin, welcome to Menswear by a Woman podcast. It is an absolute amazing and an honor to have you on here.
Samila, good morning. What a treat. It's currently very, very wet, very, very grey, very overcast here in London. But I've got to say, it's a joy to connect. It's wonderful to chat. And based on our conversation before we went live this morning, I can tell that we've got an awful lot in common. It's going to be a great chat. So thank you so much for having me.
When I see you some of your videos, and when I actually, before this podcast started, when I was researching and all that stuff, I just thought I need to talk to him because he understands the passion and the drive for something that you love so much. So, Justin, how did it all begin with watches? Let's start with that.
Here we go. How did it all start with watches? I think it really goes back. It goes all the way back to my sort of pre-teen years, I think, 10, 11, 12, on holiday with my parents who are South African. We moved from South Africa to England when I was young. Right. And I've got a sister, and we used to go predominantly, I just remember in my mind, we used to go to Turkey on holiday, and they always used to have markets. And a bit like those listening who love rummaging through vintage clothes stores and vintage markets in France and Italy and other way. And I love doing that, by the way, for clothes and for watches. But I vividly remember doing this as a kid, and I'd always pick up a fake Adidas or a Nike or a Raymond Vale watch on holiday, and I would absolutely cherish it. And by the end of the week, I'd get it on the Monday or the Tuesday. By the end of the week, I'd swam in it and completely stuffed it, and it would have broken, and it would inevitably not even be coming home with me. But the way it made me feel, the excitement in the finding it and the excitement in getting it home, and it just made me feel a certain way. And I guess it's very similar to clothing. It, wearing it, being proud of it, even at that age, made me feel a certain way. I then got a Baby G from a Japanese friend of mine at school. And again, it just made me feel a certain way. It was bright red, and it made me feel brilliant. So I guess that was the early stage. And then the sort of follow-up was for my 21st birthday, much like many other watch lovers out there. I got given a birthday present, which came from my dad, and it was his dad's only watch. And I never met my grandparents on either side. So it was my grandfather's Omega Constellation Day-Date. Wow. From the late 60s, so a sort of cushion style case, 36 millimeter, designed by the designer of the watch world, a guy called Gerald Genta, who designed the Royal Oak and the Nautilus and others. It just got me completely hooked, because I'd never had anything of that value before. I'd never had anything quite like it, and I went on a journey back to Omega to have it serviced and have a new strap, had a new strap put on it, and basically to learn. And this has been the same since for me for years now. It was the vehicle to learn about things as a result of owning them. So I went on a mission at the time, literally on forums online. Every night I'd be on forums reading about the watch, reading about new other watches, reading about what's going on out there. That was before there were blogs and websites specifically for watches. So I guess that's the story. And then it's sort of transitioned into being a job, which I never thought it ever would be. So that's really it.
So, with the passion for it, do you ever look at other people's watches and say, you shouldn't be wearing that, you should be wearing that? Or that's not
never,
me.
Never.
No,
never. Okay. I think it's slightly different. It's different actually. And I'm fortunate enough. I spent time I worked at Revolution magazine, which was partnered with the Rake magazine. So I was around, and I've been fortunate enough to make a lot of great friends who work in clothing and the menswear world. And I think objectively, you can be a bit more critical in the clothing world. And I think we probably are naturally a little bit more critical, in the sense that I might show an image of a look, a combination, and say, you know, to a friend who had worked in the industry, works in the industry, and say, you know, that probably doesn't work for that person, or that just looks bizarre. Or I think the extremes in clothing and the way that people present themselves are probably wider and further and deeper than they are in watches. For me, if someone wants to wear a watch that they're wearing a watch because, I guess this isn't very different in many ways to the clothing, but they're wearing a watch because they found it, they love it, they were given it, it says something about them, they enjoy it, it brings them joy, and they rock it with confidence, then I'm certainly not in a position to knock that. There are certain things that, you know, I don't internally and I don't publicly, I don't think, suggest, hey, you know, that's not... Of course, if we're talking about buying something, if we're talking, hey, here are the options, what do you think? Then there's definitely ways in which I feel certain people might sort of gravitate towards certain things more so than others. But if someone, and this is a classic one for a lot of watch lovers out there, you know, Hublot as a brand gets a lot of stick, and it's a brand that's very bold, it's very in your face,
yeah.
And someone who wears a Hublot, there is a characteristic type that some people might sort of connect with Hublot owners, which is probably not fair, but people will. And so inevitably, oh God, he's wearing, you know, well, she's wearing a huge Hublot, and it's like, whoa, it's so ostentatious. And I don't have a problem with that. I think they've chosen it for a reason. That's them, and they're doing it, and that needs to be celebrated.
So Justin, I'm going to put you to a test now, right?
Don't do it.
Very early stage of the podcast. How do you connect the watch with clothing? In a way, you've got clothing there, but what clothing and a watch go together? How do you do that?
Again, there are protocol, and I totally see that and I hear that. I've seen it written in menswear stories before about the etiquette, but to me. Yeah. The fun with watches is that you should absolutely dismiss all that etiquette. There is no rule book. I mean, God, it sound like a brand. There is no rule book. There is no playbook. I was wearing tracksuit bottoms yesterday with this this Ellipse that I've recently bought, this Patek Philippe Ellipse, which is a very classic dress watch. Quite small, relatively small versus other watches I have and other watches out there. And so they should not go together. This watch traditionally should be, it's time only, it's got no running seconds, it's automatic, it's elegant, under the cuff sort of stuff, and it's from one of the great makers out there, so it should be with formal wear, you know, it should be with black tie and tailoring and other things. But to me, it doesn't need to be, and the fun of it particularly is that sort of high and that low vibe. I love that. That's my favorite thing. I'm not particularly formal clothing wise, and I love wearing classic dress watches, high-end classic dress watches with more informal clothing. The only time I would probably, and I think this is, and I've never thought about this before, but the only time I would probably push back is at, say, a wedding. At a formal wedding, I would personally not like to see those large, and I love sport, by the way, as well. Sport and watching my two passions, but I don't like sports watches, big sports watches, particularly digital, sort of the running watches and training watches with formal wear. Sense. In my mind, that's just off the top of my head now. I'm just thinking that probably is the only time I would have a caveat to my rule, which is there are no rules, and you should be able to wear whatever you want with any watch you have is my quick take on it.
Well, that's true, actually, because, you know, with digital watches, right, and a suit, I sometimes don't think they go together. Certain suits, right, with a digital watch, I don't clearly think it goes together. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it just doesn't look. It doesn't look good. Let's put it this way.
No, in some ways, I think we could probably draw the line in the sand in a way that it takes away from the effort and the craft that, you know, will likely have gone into the clothing at that level, because, you know, tailoring requires that type of commitment, passion, input, and in some ways it needs to be consistent across the board. I think you'd like to see polished shoes, you'd like to see a tie done up properly, you'd like to see buttons done up, maybe you know, you'd like to see a watch then that echoes that theme, and it can be quite jarring, as you say, when you see a very big sort of you know, a digital watch that doesn't connect in any way, shape or form to the combo that's been worn. But that's probably my only caveat, I think, to that rule.
So with the digital world, right, you know how everything's becoming digital. How do you feel about digital watches? How do you guys feel about digital watches? Because you know,
great question. Because ultimately, we come to watches, mechanical watches, because they sort of have a soul to them. They've got a life to them that digital watches may not have, and certainly other things in life. I mean, people will connect cars to watches to cars because in some ways it's the same. You've got the experience element, you've got the design element, you've got the heart, the engine, the mechanics of it.
Exactly.
And then you've got the maker of these things as well, which you know is a big part of why we love them. So it's been controversial. There are some very important quartz watches that have been made over the years. For example, the Beta 21 program that IWC and Piaget and Patek were involved in the 70s, which they thought was the future of watches. That's a very interesting collecting space, and those are very interesting mechanical watches. They're not mechanical, but they're an interesting quartz watch that are put together in a certain way that is interesting technically. I've got a quartz watch, an FP Jean Elegant, which again is really interesting. The way that it goes to sleep after 20 minutes, and then you pick it up and it sets itself. And he spent 5, 6, 7 years developing that quartz movement with specialists. But to me, it's interesting because I still very much feel that it's got the creative element to it. It's still got his DNA, this particular gentleman who made it. His DNA all over it. And so I think there is appreciation out there for them. There isn't that sort of negative view maybe that electric cars get from combustion car lovers in that sense. I think people are appreciative of quartz. The value is certainly lower. There is across the board quartz is typically much lower. I think we can't not mention Swatch in the story because I'm a huge vintage Swatch lover, and Swatch for a lot of people has and is a big part of their collecting journey and their personal expression. And you know, the joy of a quartz, as I found this summer actually, is that you just don't have to worry about it. You can ride a bike on it. You don't want to necessarily ride a bike with a mechanical watch. You can play golf with it, you can swim with it, you can wear it in the sun, you can train in it if you want. All of these things that you probably wouldn't want to do with a mechanical watch. So I think it's a balance, isn't it? You know, there's joy to be had in quartz, but it probably isn't the reason that a lot of us came to the world of watches, and it probably isn't the reason that a lot of us will stay in the world of watches.
So with yourself, right, how many watches do you have?
Jesus, I mean, I need to check that my wife's not listening to this, and no one, the accountant's not listening. And it's a scary thing. It's a scary thought.
You're allowed to tell us.
You've got to. I'm a huge believer in this in life generally, and you've got to put parameters on things because it can get out of hand. And actually, when it gets out of hand, a bit like a lot of your previous guests and your listeners out there, when it comes to suits and ties and shoes and other things,
everything.
To me, the joy is in the curation. The joy is in the curation, and the joy is joy is never found in having lots and lots of things. Joy is to be had in finding the things that really matter to you in certain ways, not necessarily, and certainly not because of their price. So I try. And I have got a few watches that come and go for various reasons, for articles and reviews and videos. So I get to enjoy them, and I get to shoot them, photograph them. So I get to feel that sense of ownership and then pass them back on, which is lovely. But there are some watches that just have a special place in your heart because you might know the people, you might have had a moment in time when you bought them, you might have worn it and just realized, wow, this is just a special bit of design and you need to own them. So the long answer is here that I've got a watch box, which I have 10 slots in. A really lovely watch box that I got from my friends at Mulquin, who make leather goods. And 10 slots to me is completely excessive for the normal person out there, and it really is. But 10 to me is the limit because you have to have, they have to come and go. So if you bring one in, there has to be one that goes. So it's a one in, one out rule, and that's kind of where I'm at. And I think that the beauty is I can hold the box in my hand. I can look at them all. I can cherish them all. And most importantly, I think I can wear them all. And that's the key.
And that must be really hard to get rid of one. when another one comes in.
It is. I think the really tricky part is you want to just be critical about how much time it's being worn, because what you can do is you subconsciously look at what you have and you're like, and it's exactly the same with great jackets, for example. Like, I've got a couple of great jackets I love, and there's the idea that that's a great jacket, I love owning it, but are you actually wearing it? If you're not wearing it, I think there has to be that awareness to say, you know what, that is a wonderful object, it's not being worn by me, so someone else should be wearing it. And I think that makes it easier. I've had watches that objectively in the past would be considered important watches in the history of watchmaking, and very, very beautiful, but your tastes may change, you know, things may change in you, and over time you're like, hey, that's, you know, that was me, but it's not quite me now, I'm not wearing it as much as I would, I'm not leaning towards it in the watch box, and that's the type of internal dialogue commentary that I try to go through. But no, it's not easy to see them go, but I must have sold or moved on from what, 20 watches, 30 watches over the last decade, and I probably think about one or two actively still to this day. And it's a bit like relationships, maybe you sometimes let go of some good ones in the past, and if we're being honest, you know, sometimes you do think about one or two in the past and you wonder about how things could have been different, or did you treat them right, or did you actually put the effort in, all of those things that you might ask about relationships as well. So it is difficult, but it's part of life, and I think it's an important part of enjoying the hobby of ownership.
Justin, is watches like a status as well nowadays, because you know how people have really wealthy cars and all that stuff, it's to show off status. Are watches the same?
I think we would all be lying if we said we didn't have a bit of ego in there in some respect. Exactly. I would say, I mean, we've all got an ego, and we all want it to be massaged. And I would suggest that a lot of people I'm fortunate enough to know in the world, in the watch world, and interact with, and I'd like to think myself, but you never quite know. I'd like to think the predominant choice and the reason for the choice is because you love it, because you're excited by it, because it's got more depth than just that. But of course, you know, the status and the social play and the cultural play is important. I get a kick more out of finding things that are unusual that then go on to become status symbols or things that are culturally interesting, personally. And I recently had a very, very interesting, and I've never had it before, but I had a really interesting time where I bought a watch at auction 3-4 years ago for £150. It was a Louis Vuitton watch that there was no status attached to it whatsoever. I just happened to like it. I did some digging on it, found out that it was made by IWC, among others. It was a very early example of a ceramic case. Yeah. And for one reason or another, it wasn't because of me, this is for sure. It was a couple of other people out there who also sort of thought it was interesting, but it became really hyped up. And guys like Tyler, the Creator, and other rappers out there and other tastemakers, including Jean Arnaud, the youngest son of Bernard Arnaud, the LVMH founder, sort of richest guy in the world, got really into this watch. And so buying it 3 years ago for £150, suddenly I was actually offered, and I had actually sold it unfortunately prior to this, but around £20,000 for the watch.
What?
So you suddenly find I'd sold it for two grand to a friend of mine when I needed the money, and I thought I'd won the lottery, because you know that's you know, I wasn't doing it for the return, of course, but it's interesting to see that happen. And then suddenly you have this moment of hype, and I guess that plays into your question, which is the sort of, you know, status element of things. So I think there's almost a counter status play at the moment that's going on, which is, can you find things, or can you be involved in things, or can you own things, wear things that are just sort of not, you know, your traditional big gold flashy watch that everybody knows, but the real players out there might find things that are unusual, that are going to be interesting, or are interesting in a small sort of subset of collecting. No doubt a lot of people still love the solid gold, yellow gold GMT from Rolex or Daytona or whatever it is on Miami Beach, and that for a lot of people, and the Richard Mille, of course, the Richard Mille whole design and ethos has always been around. You know, an old boss of mine called it the billionaire's handshake. You know, if you've got a Richard Mille on and the other person's got a Richard Mille on, you can connect in a certain way. So, there is still that going on, and I don't think that will ever go. But
no, I don't
it's
think it will.
And I guess with the rise of social media, of course, we you know, that's another element of this whole thing that certainly plays to the ego. You know, no doubt having a big big watch, statement watch or whatever is part of the play. But I'd like to think it hasn't played a huge role in, or doesn't play a huge role in my thinking. The watches I like and own and wear would probably be considered a bit odd, the sort of oddballs and the bizarre stuff that maybe no one, you know, this Ellipse that I mentioned a minute ago is a watch that really wasn't very easy to sell and isn't very easy to sell from Patek to this day, which is, I think, very cool. But I think it's something that people have missed design-wise as well.
With clothing, right, I understand with, you know, when you actually pay something that's really cheap compared to something that's quite expensive. And you can feel the difference between something cheap and something expensive. With watches, right, I'm, you know, if I bought something really cheap watch and there was a very expensive watch, but they're both telling the same times, right, what's the difference? Why is it so, like, I can't explain it. So why is it those both of those watches, one which is very expensive, one which is very cheap, but they both are saying the same thing, the same time. That's all it is. Why is it so important that someone will just go over and say, no, but you got to buy the expensive one because this. But it's overall, it's just telling the time.
You've hit the nail on the head there.
It's just telling the time.
The beauty of all of this is, and I think it's the most important lesson that we all need to know, is that watches are not about telling the time. they once were. When you were, you know, when you were an elegant, you know, a woman in the 1900, early, you know, 1910, 1915, 1920, when Vacheron and some other makers were creating very elegant jewelry watches where the watch was hidden because at the time women were not, it was sort of not the thing to do was to make watches for women. A woman shouldn't have been allowed to know the time. She should ask her partner what the time is, which is nuts. And so crazy. But so these brands were making watches for women at the time. Then, of course, in the war, the men on the front line were looking at pocket watches and finding that it was incredible. Incredibly dangerous to look down and not look up above the trench, and so they started soldering pieces of metal onto the watches to create lugs to then put straps on the watches to wear them on the wrist, and they were called officers' watches or trench watches. And so it was about telling the time back then. That was very important, and it's not about telling the time now, because of course the phone and the laptop does a much better job of telling the time than any mechanical watch would.
Yeah.
Because what we find ourselves in the mechanical watch world is this is about art. This is about art. This is about artistry. This is about the makers. This is about history. This is about all of the romance that we as human beings find interesting about design in any world. I'm absolutely a believer that watches are artistic expressions of the makers and the designers and the people behind them. And so, you know, and I'm also a huge believer that price and what you pay for a watch is sort of irrelevant. It's about the value. It's not about price. It's about the value you place on it. And that's important to remember. And the value accrues over time with more experiences that you have with that watch. But if you're sitting in that boutique, and this is where it becomes a bit distorted, I guess, is you're often in these great cities around the world, and you're in these very fancy boutiques sipping on champagne, and you're looking at these watches, and you're thinking, you know, oh, I've got one for a grand, for 2.5 grand, 5 grand, 10 grand, and 50 grand. You know, what should I be buying? Well, number one, it should be about what you can buy, of course. It should never be putting yourself in a financial, but we've all done it, and I continue to do it, put myself in a financially difficult place. But it should be, of course, you know, a sensible decision to start with. But then it should be an emotional decision about which one makes you feel a certain way and which one gets you going and which one gets you excited. And in many ways, you're buying in, like if you were to buy a suit from one of the great makers out there. It's, you know, owning a Savile Row suit, I don't know if the cachet has worn off slightly in the recent years, but to me growing up, the idea of a Savile Row suit was something very special. And in many ways, if you had a Sexton suit, you were getting a bit of Edward Sexton in your life. If you had a Huntsman suit, you're getting a little bit of that from the head tailor in your life, and you're owning a little piece of them. In the same way that if you buy a Vacheron Constantin, you've got a watch from the oldest watchmaker 1755, you know, the oldest watchmaking continual production ever. And so that's what you're buying. Can you tell I'm a bit of a marketeer? So, I mean, can you tell I like a bit of marketing story?
I think you're very passionate
here.
About what you love doing. And I think you're very, what you're saying and what you're talking about is so passionate. It's about passion for the watches, you know, the action, not the watches, the industry. You know, it's a difference between being, you know, I'm totally passionate about menswear, but the whole idea of how menswear is made is a different is another level. Because it's all about the artisans, it's all about the craftsmanship, it's all about, you know, people who are there sewing and making it so special that that's what menswear is about. You know, it's not about, it's breaking the rules sometimes. You have to, you know, and you have to teach people that you can be passionate about something, but what is it that drives you to that passion, you know? And that's what I love to hear. That's what you're saying, you know, it's about the makers, it's about, you know, the designers, the makers, everyone who's involved in it. That's what the industry is about, and that's what you're saying, which is great. So I mean, I love it what you're saying about it, because it's the same value that I have for menswear as well, Justin.
And in many ways, you know, you were telling me about how your father impacted your appreciation and influenced that. And, and it's the same for me, and I'm saying for so many others, it sort of comes, and it's in the blood, as you said, as well, it's in the blood. It comes from somewhere bigger than yourself. It comes from someone you love, care about, your environment. And also supporting these artisans and supporting these people, because we don't need, you know, we don't necessarily need tailored clothing in our lives. It's not a necessity. We don't need hand-finished bridges or movements or dials or hands in our lives. But so I do feel a huge obligation and passion, excitement to support these makers, because, you know, we don't need tailoring to survive. We don't need great watchmaking to survive these days. But if you're able to, and you're that way inclined, it's wonderful to be able to support people who've spent so long training and perfecting their art. Yeah. And, you know, that's a huge part of the joy for me. And that's one of the great things actually about the digitization of our lives, is that with social and other platforms, you get to learn more about these people really quick, and you get to learn about their stories. And it would have taken an awful lot longer decades ago to come across a great cutter. Or tie maker, but or cobbler, but these days it is easier, and certainly, you know, great makers do find their way out into the ether. So, you know, that's all part of the puzzle there.
Do you think at the moment with the industry, with the watch industry, is it growing more, or has it declined after COVID? What's happening with the industry?
It's been growing rapidly for many, many years now. It's continued to grow, and I think it speaks to the younger generation's appreciation for objects that aren't redundant. You know, that's of course one of the main reasons why mechanical watches over quartz are always favoured and supported traditionally. Because to me, luxury. And it definitely extends to clothing as well. To me, luxury is anything that can be worked on in the future and brought back to life. And so it really, watchmaking speaks to a generation of people coming through who want to have something that's valuable, that holds value, something that is valuable emotionally, something that can be serviced and can be passed on. And as much as it's a cliche, and we all know the Patek ad, which by all accounts was one of the Stern family who owns Patek, literally overhearing a sales associate one year saying this to a client, you know, you never actually own a Patek Philippe, you merely look after it for the next generation. And that in many ways has gone on to shape the whole watch world. So we've seen growth continue, which is amazing. And we've seen more brands come into the marketplace, particularly independent brands, small makers. But the biggest area of growth has certainly been in the secondary market. So, you know, watches predominantly used to be sold by retailers on behalf of the brand. Mm-hmm. What's happened in the last couple of years is the brands have started to open up their own locations, so cutting out the retailers and going direct to the customer and selling new watches. And then increasingly, they've also then been asked by clients who came back to them, hey, you know, I'd love to buy a new watch, but I've got an old watch, or I'd love to sell my old watch. How do I do that? And so now some of the big groups have actually invested in the secondary market, the pre-owned watch business, which has been growing at a serious level for the last couple of years. So, you know, we're talking about a multi-billion dollar industry just in the secondary market. We're talking about multi-billion dollar business, 20 plus billion dollar business just out of Switzerland every year of new watches. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge industry, which, yeah, needs that level of investment to continue to support watchmakers, because watchmakers, skilled watchmakers, particularly in the UK, are very hard to come by these days. So it's in a really good place, but it's interesting that you note the pandemic.
Yeah,
sorry, because the pandemic was very difficult for so many of us, very difficult for all of us, but very, very good for business, particularly sort of the higher end element of the watch industry, because it certainly allowed people to fulfill their passions, to spend more time and money on what they love, and watches it was one of those things. So a lot of independent brands just blew up. A lot of brands like AP, Vacheron Constantin did incredibly well in the pandemic. So, and then what then happened as a subsequent to that, as a result of that, was that secondary market prices went absolutely nuts. And watches that retail, for example, like the Royal Oak from AP, a £26,000 watch new, which is an awful lot of money if you can get one. They don't provide them to very many people. But then at the peak was going for £100,000in the pandemic, when people just couldn't get hold of them and were desperate to buy and saw the investment never cooling. But it is now cooling, for sure. That same watch is now worth less than half of that. And it's back to a level that probably feels more manageable and realistic for everybody. It wasn't a good thing that numbers got so crazy for a lot of people in the industry, both in terms of buyers and the brands themselves. As a collector, you're thinking, God, I'm never going to be able to get that because it's just ridiculously expensive now. Suddenly, interesting watches have become more approachable in price within the last 12 months, and I think they'll continue to do so. And I think we'll probably see a lot of smaller brands, particularly brands under the, say, £5,000 mark, we will sort of lose a few of those because there are too many brands right now out there. Mm. I think those that have built the right foundations, those that know their clients, this is probably the key element. Those that know their clients, have a great relationship and a direct connection to their clients, will be the ones that prosper in the next few years. But I think we'll lose a lot of others out there that don't offer something distinct, offer something strong and distinct.
Justin, how does smaller brands survive in the watch industry because of the big names? You know, because, you know, how much, you know, the financially and what they are doing, and the bigger brands. It's the same bit like the clothing brand as well, but with the smaller brands and watch, how do they survive in trying to keep up or be different?
It's tricky because it's incredibly expensive to start a brand, you know, just the making of these things is expensive, and the skills required to make them is expensive. Totally depends on what part of the market you're coming in at. We've seen a couple of independents pop up at the very high level. Simon Brevet, for example, at the very top level, is an independent watchmaker who probably makes 10 watches a year, 5-10 watches a year, the same as Roger Smith in the Isle of Man. And, you know, for them, it's just important to get buy-in, early buy-in from a few big collectors who want to support. The way it typically works is they run an initial series of watches called the souscription. I hope my French is okay. They are the first series of watches that then allow collectors to own something really fresh, really new and exciting. Yeah. Okay. And it pays for the business to launch. And that happened with a couple of key makers in the past. But then, you know, we look at other brands at the other end of the spectrum. In the UK, we've got a lot of really exciting young independent brands coming through, like Studio Underdog, by a fellow who started in lockdown. He worked at Braun as a designer, and those watches are less than £1,000, just over £1,000. And, you know, in some respects there, people are looking at Kickstarter. and trying to launch a brand in that way. It might be because they have a great colorful dial, they have some fun play from a design perspective, like Studio Underdog, or someone like Farah in the UK, again a brand that's a more approachable price point. But then you can play around with things like the way in which the time is reflected. So, you know, we don't just have hour hands and minute hands these days. Mm. We've got really unusual ways of telling time. We've got ways that, you know, a Montre Attack, where you've got the time displayed between the lugs at the bottom of the watch. You've got a star wheel, where literally these wheels are moving around. These wheels are literally rotating on the dial, clicking into place and dragging across the dial in a retrograde fashion to tell you the hour and the minutes. We've got jump hour, where you've got just a big window in the dial itself with the number, which shows you the hours, and then another hand to show you the minutes. So you can be really creative. That it's endless how many different ways you can tell time, and it's endless the different kinds of shapes that you find out there. And particularly now, we've got more avant-garde designs from independent watchmakers than ever before, and that's, Sam's, is one of the key growth areas has been through independence in the last few years. Those makers like, and if anyone is not familiar with them, I urge you to check them out. Brands like Laurent Ferrier, very, very elegant watch brand, very small manufacturer, you know, they've been blowing up. Brands like MBNF, Max Busser and friends on the other end of the spectrum, very, very avant-garde, mad watches, which he is basically just a crazy genius who was inspired by Transformers and crazy worlds. That as a kid, he's just manifested them into watches that are upwards of 50 to 100 to 150,000 pounds a pop. So it's the spectrum is so wide. There's something for everybody out there. But the only way you can differentiate yourself is through design or people. You know, a lot of these brands are reflected by their owners, their watchmaking owners, who are still present. And that's a part of the story that differentiates them as well. But it's not easy, really not easy out there, that's for sure. But I hope that answers your question.
Are watches becoming genderless? Because
absolutely.
Because I've always liked men's watches. I've never liked women's watches. Mm. I've always felt like, why do they make women's watches so small? And, you know, but I can see it's changing. Mm. But are they becoming more genderless? Like, I would wear a man's watch anyway. I always have done. So, you know. Is it becoming more like that, or what's happening?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. To the extent that, thankfully now, that the brands themselves, and I've had conversations with a few over the years to say that, you know, there shouldn't be a men and a woman's tab on the website. You know, the watch is very much you coming to the table of watches and deciding what works for you. That's it. Yeah. I think gone are the days of them designing for men or women, particularly with the rise of Asia. You know, the Asian market is such a huge driver of sales that, you know, traditionally, you know, the big makers would have said, hey, in Japan, you know, the men are looking for 34, 35, 36 millimeter case sizes with some stone on there, with some precious metal. Precious metal. Whereas in the Middle East, they're obviously, for various reasons, they're not looking for precious metals or colored precious metals, but they're looking for bigger watches. Mm-hmm. Of course, in America, they're looking for big watches in certain regions of America as well. So to me, it really is wonderful to see that has now disappeared. And it is very much about you saying, hey, this is what I love. I love the fact that you love bigger watches. Nothing to me is more attractive personally than to see an oversized case dress watch, you know, sports watch on a female wrist, which is sort of typically smaller. Very, very elegant. I love it. Who's done it very well for many, many years without being told to or asked to are the Italian woman and the French woman have always, from my memory, done that with Rolex and Patek Philippe and others, where you see, you see a Nautilus, you know, 38 or 40 millimeter sports watch on the wrist of a smaller, elegant woman who's layered up in the Parisian winter months. God, I mean, it doesn't get more elegant than that.
I would wear a sports watch. Actually, I have done. I've wore a sports watch with my brother's sports watch, because he's really into watches, right? And I think it's one of those, I've forgotten the name of the brand, but it was very expensive and it was very heavy. So I put it on and I wore a sari with it. And
Mm.
And we was at a wedding, and he looked over and he said, "Have you got my watch on?" It's like, yeah.
And brilliant, always the way.
His face just turned like saying, "Do you know how expensive that watch is?" I said, "Yeah, don't worry, no one's going to nick it. We're at a wedding, so we'll be fine." He said, "It's not about nicking. It's just the fact that you better look after it. Otherwise, don't take it off.
I love it.
It was funny, but it was so big and it was so heavy. And it was like, and he said, "Don't take it off. Now that you've got it on you, right, just don't take it off. And then don't scratch it. Don't do this. Don't." So throughout the whole wedding, that's all I heard him. "Don't do this. Don't do that. Be careful how you put your wrist on the table."
I love it. I love it. And in many ways, you know, the funny thing is that I'm sure that added value to the watch to him, you know, seeing you wearing it and finding joy in it. That's what it's all about. And
well, Justin, when he was in the car, he said, "Give me the watch."
Yeah. As long as it comes home, ultimately,
yeah,
as long as
it comes
home,
now.
I'm
give
sure.
No. How is it that at the moment, right, you know how everything is with cost of living and everything, are people still buying expensive watches? I suppose the rich are.
Yeah. And so the rich are getting richer, which we hear a lot. Yeah. And you can certainly see that in different ways. Well, prices across the board are going up for brands, so particularly at the high end, middle to high end, because they want to try and protect the equity in the product. And the big collectors, and the auctions are going on right now in Geneva, where the big sort of collectors come out, and the big auction houses, Phillips, Christie's, Sotheby's, Antiquorum, they are selling watches. You know, they're selling whole series of watches, upwards of, you know, 100, 150, 200,000, up to multi-million, price points. And so that's not unusual at the very, very top end. I think the new stuff coming through on the high street, brands that are upper to high end brands, and I probably put them in the ultra lux category, which is sort of 15,000 and upwards on the high street. If you go to New Bond Street today, Vacheron, for example, have had an amazing few years. They are still going to have an amazing few years. Patek are having an amazing time, and they'll continue to have an amazing time. AP have been an amazing year or two, a decade, and they're going to have a great decade to come, I've got no doubt. But the brands that are fighting at the lower end, sort of the under, and I say lower end in a totally respectful fashion of the fact that this is still a great deal of money, but you get used to talking about it like this from a business perspective. Yeah. I would say the things that are competing, you know, in the 2,000-4,000 pound category are finding it very difficult, and I think will continue to find it difficult. And certainly those that are less than that, because then they start to compete with smartwatches directly. That's going to be tricky for them, no doubt. That's going to be tricky for them. So the outlook, the last few years have been amazing for the industry. The outlook is that it's going to become increasingly more difficult. And that's also fundamentally because, not because of the cost of living crisis, but actually because when you buy luxury, and I heard this from a CEO the other day, which is absolutely right, when I was interviewing him, he said, you've got to be in the right mindset. It's not about the money necessarily for a lot of these buyers. It's more about the mindset. You want to be in the right mindset to buy something. So walking into Piaget and you want to spend 20,000 quid on a watch, you've got to have the right mindset. And a lot of these people, a lot of these buyers are impacted by, as we all are, by the events around the world, seeing the images that we see from all the different conflicts going on in the world and the various challenges that we face. Those are the types of things that impact, obviously fiscally for some, but it's more emotionally. They're being influenced and impacted by the current affairs in the world. So they're more conscious of that, that the uncertainty, the fear, the anxiety. When you're in a state of anxiety, you're not in a state of being excited about getting that Anderson and Shepherd suit made for you.
No, exactly. So what's the what's the most expensive watch out there at the moment, Justin? The most expensive one?
The most expensive watch? Bloody hell. Well, there's been some controversy this year for a number of different controversies in the industry, but one recently is called the only watch auction. It's called the Only Watch Auction. It's been going on for 10-ish years now.
Okay.
And it was started by a chap who unfortunately lost his son to muscular dystrophy. And it was started to raise money for muscular dystrophy. And the brands all got behind it. And they all donated a watch that was a bespoke watch, a one-of-one watch, every year to this auction. And they sold them. And the money was believed to be going directly to the charities involved. Mm-hmm. And it may still. We don't know. But what's happened this year is a lot of people in the community have raised concerns about where that money has been going, because he's raised hundreds of millions of pounds for the charities and research. And it's been cancelled this year. And we're talking about all the big brands pretty much participating, and AP removed their lots because there was not clear, consistent clarity on what the auction was doing with the raised funds. And the reason I bring them up is because the most expensive wristwatch sold at auction was a watch made by Patek Philippe called the Grandmaster Chime, which I think sold 2-3 years ago at the Only Watch for £35 million plus.
Whoa.
Which is an awful lot of money.
Wow.
Which is an awful lot of money. And it's a bloody awful looking watch as well, to add insult to injury. But relatively speaking as well, it should be said that these auction houses, you know, these big auction houses selling art for a lot more money than these watches. These watches are actually still a relatively small part of their business, which is kind of nuts. But that's a watch at auction. So auction, obviously, can go anywhere and the numbers can go crazy. But I think you're probably more suggesting, what is a watch? If we went onto Bond Street today and tried to buy a watch, what would we could we spend if we had endless amounts of money? Well, the tricky part about that, Sommelier, is actually that a lot of these brands, and they're the masters of supply and demand, they typically don't have them available. So if we walked into Patek Philippe today, they would laugh at us if we asked them for a Grandmaster Chime. Because for a Grandmaster Chime, the watch I just referenced, you can buy them new, but not a piece unique one, but a regular one, quote unquote regular one. They would laugh us out the door, because you would have to be a very, very big client of theirs already.
Right.
And you would have to go through some level of process, like an interview or some level of questioning, before you would actually be allocated a watch like that. So the reality is, it retails for probably £1 million plus. I don't even know, because it's not even in the catalogue with a price tag next. It's like when you go to a fancy restaurant, it says price on application, POA. You know you're in trouble. But, you know, that's the thing, right? So even if you went to AP and said, I really want a ceramic. So Ed Sheeran recently did an interview on one of the big websites called Hodinkee. And he did an interview about his collection. And he showed a white ceramic Royal Oak perpetual calendar from AP that was designed for him, bespoke. You can buy a regular version of that for a couple of £100,000. But again, they're never going to sell it to you, because they need to know you. They need to feel like they know who they're selling to. They want to know fundamentally that you're not going to sell it for more. You're not going to walk out the boutique and sell it straight away for a huge amount more. And that's the tricky part. So it's not them necessarily just being pompous twats, which it kind of is in some respects, but it's not entirely, because they also want to protect their business.
Of course.
So it's a very interesting market out there. Very, very interesting.
I know. It sounds, I feel like I want to do it. I feel like I want to go for an interview with them to see what happens, you know, just to see what the questionnaire is going to be about, you know. Wow!
Can you imagine?
Like, you know, and then they tell you the price. You're thinking, I can't even afford that anyway. So, after all that, what's the worst watch in the market at the moment? Are you allowed to tell us? You're not allowed to tell us.
The worst watch in the market. I would honestly say, Tom's, that there isn't a worse watch in the market. You know, someone is buying the thing. Someone's designed it. I think, I don't know if it's the same in the clothing world, the men's world, the style world. But the community is quite visceral now. The online community is quite sort of open and direct, and not afraid to say how they feel.
Right.
And in many respects, I support that. Because they're holding people to account. You know, they're calling up journalists like me and the media. They're saying, hey, you're just being paid to talk like that, which is great. You know, that's not right. Sometimes you've got to be straight, and all the time you've got to be straight down the line, and you've got to be honest. They're calling out brands for selling things that aren't right. They're calling out auction houses like this. They're calling out all sorts of things. I have a line, though, and the line has to be that you can't get personal with people and you can't call them out. And in some respects, I also sort of draw the line around product and calling it out negatively, because I'm happy to call it out negatively if you ask, and I'll say I don't like it. But ultimately, someone has designed it. Someone has invested time in making it. Someone is, you know, there has been thought that's gone into it, even though it might not feel like there has been. And so there is no bad watch out there, I would say. There are some brands that sort of take the piss with their pricing. There are some brands that take the piss with how they treat you as clients. Yeah. That's not cool. All of that is not cool. No. And that needs to be called out. Bad watch. A bad watch is one in which you aren't made to feel worthy of them. You're not made to feel welcome of that by them. You're not made to feel like it was a positive experience buying the watch or owning the watch. A watch that doesn't work properly. One that you're charged an awful lot of money for a service that shouldn't have been the case, for various reasons. So I think all of those things play into a bad watch and a bad watch experience. But I can't think of a bad watch right off the top of my head, because they fit somebody out there, just may not necessarily be me.
Right. That's a good answer.
Terrible answer.
No, but
you wanted some juice. You wanted a juicy answer there.
But, you know, it's a good answer, and it's a very honest answer. So I think I would say the same with clothing as well. You know, I don't think I could fault anyone out there at the moment. No one, because everybody puts
Who would you say is? I can't help myself as a sort of wannabe journalist. But is there one maker out there that you absolutely love? That if you could have one maker make everything for you out there, who would it be? And then if there were one maker that, because they're negative and not because they're not worthy, but because they just don't speak to you, that you would absolutely not go to, that also happens to be quite popular.
Oh my God. You put me on the spot now, Justin. I think there is a lot of them out there that I would love to get my things made by them. So that's what I'm going to say. I'm not going to say the name of the brand, Justin. As you didn't as well.
Okay.
But there is
okay.
some magic that they have and they don't realize. I'm going to find a way to convince them that, hey, you know, come on to my podcast because you've got this absolutely amazing brand. So let's put it that way.
Calling them out might not be such a bad thing, because...
No, I might just on my Instagram story, and that will tell everyone who I'm talking about. So when this comes out, this episode, everyone's going to be glued onto that story, because I might just announce them on the story to say, hey, come out, you know, just come onto my podcast and talk about your magic in your brand.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I'm excited by it as well. And so those would be the ones that would they be the ones you want everything made from, everything done from, everything?
Yeah, I would actually. I would. Last of all, Justin, what are you doing next? What's your projects? Are you allowed to tell us what you're up to next?
Yes, Emily. Yeah. So it's actually funny you should say projects, because that is very much how I feel that things unravel for me work-wise. It's kind of like a series of projects, and there's this. I guess I'm dyslexic, seriously as well as you, and also sort of just like ADHD vibes and other things going on for me. So anything where there's continual movement, new things, new challenges, probably not ones that I necessarily have to provide too much detail on. I'm sort of, I love the big picture ideas and getting involved in those things. And so in many ways, these projects I'm working on at the moment are great fun. So I've got a couple of book projects, which are really exciting. I'm doing a 12-year anniversary book for one of my favorite independent watchmakers called Ressence out of Belgium, with a colleague of mine, Stephen Pulverant, who was at Hodinkee for many years. So I'm really excited about that. IWC are probably my oldest partners and clients, the guys that really got me into watchmaking. And I've got my own book coming out, which I do every year, which is in the fourth year now, called The Watch Annual.
Yeah.
And I do that with two great friends of mine, Kieran and James. And we basically ask the community to contribute their favorite watches that were launched this year.
Right.
And then we choose our favorites. So we've got 100 watches that came out this year in one book. £2 of every book goes to a charitable cause every year. So this year it's going to the Red Cross, and we don't have any advertisers or sponsors. So it's just a very much self-funded project that is community driven.
Right.
And That's called The Watch Annual. So we're in the fourth year, and it is available on Mr. Porter. There is a limited edition that we do for Mr. Porter. And we also create a bespoke piece of artwork, which this year we have done. And it's a very special watch, which is going to be announced next week. So that's it, really. I've got lots of writing going on with different places and different things. But that's the main focus right now, Soms.
Wow, that's a lot going on, Justin. I love the way you say that's it, basically.
Yeah, it's all fun though. God, it never feels like work. It really doesn't.
Of course
so,
not.
I'm
never.
Very grateful. Very
and as
grateful.
They say, if you're passionate about something so much, it's not work, which is true,
no,
right?
It really isn't.
On that note, Justin, I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming on to Menswear by a Woman podcast. It's been an absolute amazing. I love it. I loved it. And absolutely honoured for it. Totally honoured that you came on to it.
Samuel, thank you so much. Honestly, there's nothing I enjoy more than sharing the passion. And I've so enjoyed meeting you. And thank you for having me on.
And the other thing that I wanted to say was the last thing is I'm so glad that you've actually say that wearing a watch, it's not about the time. It's not about telling the time because I'm never on time. I've never been on time for anything. So
ironically, never am I.
Thank you once again, Justin. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.